Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Ipsen, we had the pleasure of speaking with Arturo Loaiza Bonilla, MD, MSED, FACP, Gastroenterology Program Director and Medical Director of Clinical Research at the Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia to discuss treatment planning in metastatic pancreatic cancer. In our exclusive interview, Loaiza Bonilla discussed approaches to frontline treatment selection in metastatic pancreatic cancer, the impact of adverse effects and toxicities in treatment planning, and treatment options available to patients post-gemcitabine-based regimens. Thank you so much, Dr. Bonilla, for joining us on another episode of Onc Live On Air. Nice to have you back again.
Thanks for having me, as always.
I think last time you were here, we were talking about AI and oncology, and now we're going to take a slight shift and talk about treatment in pancreatic cancer. How do you approach treatment planning at diagnosis when you meet that patient?
Pancreatic cancer is one of those diseases that doesn't give you any warning. Most patients come with non-specific findings, such as abdominal pain. They may have jaundice, and they had a CAT scan and unfortunately showed that disease was already either locally advanced or resectable, which is a very common situation, just basically the tumors invading those vessels that are hard to remove by the surgeon. The other component is patients with metastatic disease. So over half of patients present with metastatic disease. I think 52% is the latest data I remember, top of my head. But if you put all together, it's about 85% of patients present with disease that is not really amenable for surgery. So my approach to them is, of course, complete full staging. And one thing that I feel is being not seen as often is getting biomarker testing for these patients. So the NCCN recommends that every patient should have germline and also somatic testing for looking for potential alterations that we can target. We have some FDA-approved drugs for example, BRCA mutations in germline settings. But we also can find other mutations that are relevant that could be targeted in the future, hopefully in the context of clinical trials.
So I'm assuming the answer to my next question is yes, but I'm going to ask it nonetheless. Do you consider the course of therapy beyond the first line at diagnosis?
Yes, absolutely. I think that I'm a very proactive individual in terms of how I want to treat my patients. I try to think about it. Is I treating my family or myself? What would I prefer to do? So I want to give them the best chance I can, of course, keeping the expectations, realistic, but also knowing that patients can go across multiple lines and still being able to derive treatment benefit. So that's my plan always from the get-go, being smart, being planner in terms of what you're supposed to go through and look for, clinical trials, what is new, what's coming, what are the best options currently available based on, NCCN guidelines and pathways, whatever is available at your institution. I'm always asking patients to be their own advocates and being proficient on that.
In keeping with this idea of planning, how can you be proactive about the management of disease progression?
Something at least that is encouraging is over the last, decade or so, we've seen new drugs coming down the pipeline. So if you go back to 1996, we have gemcitabine only and fluorouracil. Then we started seeing that most patients were able to get into second line of treatment. So I think in the past, it was about 40% of patients maximum got into second line. Now we're getting into the realm of 60% of patients able to get that because the treatment options got better. Also symptom management, for example, inclusion of patients in the palliative care plans for pain management, for dietary support, all of that is key. So the way I see this is being proactive in terms of symptom management, being proactive in biomarker findings, and using the right drug for the right time when it's most appropriate. So hopefully we're going to get more and more data coming in terms of new biomarkers, new options that we can use for our patients. But, it's getting a little bit better. So we have, at least for a few patients, we have, MSI high. We need to test for it. For some others, it could be TMB high, 10 and above. Unlike other disease types, such as, for example, colon cancer, a TMB of 10 or 12 may not mean anything in terms of response to immune therapy, but in pancreas cancer, it does make a difference, even though not everyone responds and, things could be better. I mean, at this juncture, understanding that pancreatic cancer has been the most difficult in terms of phase three clinical trial success stories. So if you look at the whole phase three clinical trial of the last decade of all tumor types, all of them have, overcome a threshold of at least 30% success stories. We don't see that in pancreas. And that reflects on mortality and reflects on the options that we have. So we have a few of them. You may have some, folks saying, oh, it's not sufficient. I agree. But, we should grasp what we can and just take it from there. So that's kind of like my motto behind it.
And in terms of clinical signs of progression, what should you be looking for?
As you ask the patient in your clinical duties, it's always key to listen to them. They know much better than us typically when things are happening. So we always follow typical, standard of care RECIST criteria and tumor marker assessment and all that. But it's not uncommon that it may be, for example, that the patient is having increased, abdominal pain, like the whatever celiac plexus that you did before the intervention with that is wearing off, or the patient has ongoing issues with symptom management, right? And then you have to decrease the dosing of certain drugs, and that eventually leads to less effect and potentially progression of disease. So I'm very proactive at the beginning. I tend to do scans actually early in the game when I see the patient and start the patient on treatment on first line. I like to do a scan within, 6 to 8 weeks maximum, just to assess those patients who are not, good responders to the treatment I'm offering. And then if everything's okay, then I go to the every 3 month schedule that most people do, unless something happens on the blood work that is telling me otherwise. And we're learning now, of course, this is not mainline yet, but we're seeing some interesting results in the terms of circulating tumor DNA testing. So maybe that's going to help us to really see which patients are the better responders, which patients are going to, predict potential progression sooner, so we can be more proactive in finding studies for them, doing more biomarker testing for them. So it's getting there. I feel that if we, move a little bit clock for about a few years, we're going to get there at some point.
And what would you say are the effects of adverse effects and toxicities in treatment planning, particularly once the patient has progressed on frontline therapy?
I think that is really a major issue in terms of managing our patients, because they're not only dealing with pancreas cancer, which on its own has its own subset of issues and complications, such as abdominal pain or biliary obstruction that needs to be solved often, change stents, and that hampers the ability to get certain drugs. But also many of the drugs that we use in the first line setting, they have, neuropathy, for example, inducing for our patients. So even if you use, oxaliplatin-based treatment or some form, sometimes cisplatin in rare cases, you use that, but I typically use more FOLFIRINOX, for example, if you're going to use it in first line, or if you use gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, it also has neuropathy. And you do those adjustments, you change the schedule to every other week, you drop down the oxali or take it away and keep the patient certain things. But those side effects are lingering, and they stay for the patient for the duration of their disease. Being proactive, of course, is essential, but also knowing when is good time to stop or hold certain drugs is key, because we don't want to create disability when the patient's already being affected by a disease that is, very hard to deal with.
And would you say that that's sort of a data-driven approach or more driven by anecdotal experience?
So, I think it's mostly these anecdotal experience. I don't think we have enough data to tell us how patients do in the continuum of care. We need more real-world data that is actionable in that setting. We know that neuropathy is real, that something happens with those patients after a certain amount of time, that we can, for example, stop the nab-paclitaxel, and half patients can go back with an adjusted dose and continue treatment after that. But eventually, this is progression ensues, and we need to change gears to something else. So that also begs the question, it doesn't make sense sometimes to go from, something that induces neuropathy to another, nerve damaging agent, for example. So that should be always part of the equation of what we're discussing, but it becomes more like something like science is based, but also is the art of medicine when you actually discuss with the patients and make sure that you make the right goals.
Now, assuming the patient did get gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel as frontline therapy, what are some treatment options available to them upon progression on that regimen?
NCCN guidelines offer a number of different options for these patients. The only one that is showing up based on a phase 3 clinical trial is liposomal irinotecan plus 5-FU and leucovorin. So that's the category 1 recommendation at NCCN. There's others, of course, including FOLFOX. You can try FOLFIRINOX. I wouldn't recommend FOLFIRI. There's the data on that is very poor. So I either go all the way with FOLFIRINOX or just or rather stay with the, you know, the data, the phase 3 data from Napoli 1. And there's other things available, of course, if you happen to randomly do genomic testing and now you found the patient has MSI high or it has a higher TMB, you may have that discussion with the patient. But typically just those are the options. Unfortunately, in pancreas cancer, we wouldn't have too many. Maybe you find an NTRK fusion and there's like, you know, jackpot, then the patient's going to be great with just a pill. Hopefully we find more of those drugs in the future.
And in terms of patient convenience, is there a particular regimen that is attractive?
I mean, convenience is, I mean, the convenience will be, you know, something that is long lasting, that it doesn't, you have to have just often, but we don't have that many options for patients with pancreas cancer, unfortunately. So in the, particularly in the second line setting, post-gemcitabine based treatments, everything it has to be with a pump in most cases. So you either do the 5-FU onivide or liposomal irinotecan, you call it, or you do the FOLFIRINOX. Or the FOLFOX, all of them require a 5-FU pump. The key thing is, are we going to add on more toxicities? Are we going to, depending on how the patient is feeling? And also, for example, the user growth factor support is a key challenge as well. We're getting issues with insurance companies, sometimes denying certain things, or the biosimilars are exploding as well. So which one works for which patient or based on the insurance type? So that also plays into my consideration if I want to add on a regimen that may have a higher incidence of neutropenia or a severe neutropenia requiring growth factor support. Of course, I use modified FOLFIRINOX in all my patients, but that doesn't you know, make the trick in every single patient.
Now, looking to the future and kind of now that we're a couple months out from ASCO, were there any particular data sets or presentations or even, you know, trials in progress that you'd like to call attention to?
Certainly. I think the pancreatic cancer has a number of genomic biomarkers that are present. The most relevant is KRAS. That happens in 90% of the patients with pancreatic cancer. But there's different KRAS subsets, right? There's different variants, different mutations that we have. We don't have anything approved for KRAS, but it used to be an undruggable drug. And now we have, you know, sotorasib and now adagrasib in clinical trials that are targeting KRAS G12C, which is a smaller subset of pancreas cancer, but still relevant. So I think we should hopefully learn more from those. And I'm hopeful that it will give us good results, if maybe in combinations as well with certain drugs as well. As in colon, there's, for example, combination with cetuximab and something like that, that may be, you know, the secondary activation of the RAS pathway could be overcome by that. There's other for G12D, also in the pipeline in the future. If you don't have a KRAS mutation, basically you have KRAS wild type, then there is some reports that you have a higher incidence of fusions that you should be looking for. So those are the patients that I really do the tissue-based, genomic-based testing to make sure that I don't miss, you know, a random NTRK fusion or ALK or, you know, or something like that, or a BRAF mutation, which could be targeted based on clinical trials. Or maybe if it's an NTRK case, for example, you can use any of those TKIs that are very effective in control of the disease in most patients. And we need to decode the tumor mutational burden, as I mentioned, for some patients that are not able to, you know, have the threshold for treatment. And we also saw some interesting data that is emerging of the combination of, you know, standard of care chemo, for example, gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, with this drug called moxifortide, which is actually used for stem cell harvesting for transplant for myeloma, for example, for auto transplant. And it seems like it leads to a modification of the stroma to some extent. And in combination with immune checkpoint inhibitors, it has very promising early data. So I'm hopeful that we're going to see more of those results down the line. So those are the few things that are happening in the space. Hopefully we find more biomarkers that we can target. And of course, we have the BRCA, you know, the homologous recombination deficient tumors using olaparib for some of those patients. Not everyone benefits. So hopefully we can find ways to really make those changes and make it more efficient for most patients if they use it.
Is there anything else that you wanted to highlight that I didn't already ask you?
I think that first, look for clinical trials. Right? So that's the challenge. That we need to be very proactive, be on top of it, be a planner. Look at the inclusion exclusion criteria of many studies, because sometimes that's one of the key points that is missed, that if most trials start with gemcitabine-based chemotherapy as a requirement for second line, then I mean, maybe that's something that we should be thinking of in first line most often. Given the data, there's no head-to-head comparison between FOLFIRINOX and gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. This, of course, my personal preference. Most of the clinical trials in first line are gemcitabine-based treatment, and most second line clinical trials, they are asking for patients to have some form of gemcitabine-based drugs just because of requirements. Just be very proactive in the way you do this. Don't wait until the last minute to look for studies. There's different tools. So PanCAN, Luz Garden Foundation are doing that. Of course, personally, I have Massive Bio helping us with patients as well. So different things that we can always do to help patients find their way. For me, pancreas cancer is one of those that we really need to crack the code and help more patients. So hopefully we can all work together on that.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Ipsen. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.